sometimes behave so strangely. Hello and welcome to another episode of the So Strangely podcast, a podcast on recent research in music science. With me today is Dr. Sarah Sovi, postdoctoral fellow at Memorial University in Newfoundland. And we'll be discussing her recommendation of individual differences in rhythmic cortical entrainment correlate with predictive behavior in sensory motor synchronization, published in Nature Scientific Reports by Sylvie Nosredin, Isabel Peretz, and Peter Keller. So, Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Can you give us a little context for this paper? Where does this situate in music science?
Most of it is in the title. So we're talking about sensory motor, we're talking about synchronizations, and we're talking about EEG and some cortical entrainment. And this is a little bit interesting for me because all of these things are separate from what I consider my niche. And so this was something that came about as I joined my new lab now, and this is work that they had done. And so Ben said, I have some data for you to analyze. So this fits into this whole idea of the importance of meter in music. And meter is a really interesting concept in itself, I think, because it doesn't necessarily actually exist in the signal. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a note for us to hear a beat. And it happens at different hierarchies, and some of us hear meter at slightly different levels, a whole nested rhythmic perception thing. Mm-hmm. And I found this paper really, really interesting because it brought together this perception of meter and the production of meter and how that actually works in the brain. Mm-hmm. And then they throw in individual differences as well. In psychology, there's two sides. There's either we try to make generalizations and find big patterns in things, or we look at how people differ. Mm-hmm. And those are very different approaches, and this one centers more on the individual differences between people.
Okay, well, off of that, I'm going to try to lay out the specifics of what happens mm-hmm. in this paper, the experiments that it describes. As you were saying, this paper looks at multiple measurements of entrainment across different domains and then looks at their relationship as differences between participants. And it's a really interesting combination of measurements of what we could say as being like metrical perception and then also metrical behavior and production of beat. The first thing that they did was look at listening tasks where they were recording EEG measurements while people were hearing a couple different rhythms cycling at different tempi. So they talk about using a syncopated rhythm and an unsyncopated rhythm. And we can discuss how precise these terms are. But anyway, that's the main contrast between these two. And the unsyncopated rhythm has an onset on every beat, whereas a syncopated rhythm has a beat only on the downbeat of a three-beat rhythm with the same number of onsets. So just to give you some context, this is the unsyncopated rhythm. And if you need to hear where the beat is on that, it would be. And I will not tell you how much practice that took, because it would be embarrassing. Whereas the syncopated rhythm, as I said, has the same number of onsets, but leaves gaps specifically where the beat would be for two of the three of the cycle. So the syncopated rhythm. And with the beat articulated, it would be. So they were hearing each of these played for about 30 seconds at different tempi. And what they were looking at in the EEG was how clearly a frequency came out at that beat level specifically. So the frequency of the for each of those. Mm-hmm. Now, for something that had a beat articulated in the onsets, you would expect there to be a rhythm that would be the result of like evoked potentials in reaction to the sound. But for the syncopated rhythm, there is no frequency articulated at the beat level, but amplitude at the pulse in the EEG would suggest mm-hmm. kind of endogenous process emphasizing the beat. And in using this particular analysis, which they call steady state evoked potentials, they're able to show that in the syncopated rhythms, there was energy there, which was similar, if not necessarily as strong as what was there in the unsyncopated rhythm. And so that just by itself is a nice result, an expression of a cycle of evoked potentials in the brain, whether or not that was something that was in the stimulus. which we could then say to be an expression of metrical entrainment. So off of that, then they then had participants tapping to these rhythms, supposedly at the beat level, mostly at the beat level. They left that kind of open, but they studied how well they were entraining in a tapping task. And they looked at two aspects of the tapping task. Specifically, they were looking at mean asynchrony, so whether they were on the beat, leading or following the beat, and also the precision, so how close they were to the beat, to see how these two different aspects of a tapping task would then relate maybe to these measurements that were in the neural entrainment data. And then on top of that, they had a different task for tapping that wasn't with these particular beats, but with something else entirely, where the tempo varied in a naturalistic way. And they looked at how well they predicted and adapted to changing tempo, which is something that musicians learn to do, but might not be as obvious, say, for people that haven't had that kind of practice. And with all these different measurements combined, they looked at how they predicted each other, specifically how the performance of the prediction of tempo variation, the accuracy of tapping asynchrony, and the precision of tapping timing were predicted by neural entrainment measurements and the years of experience. And by using multiple regression models, they were able to figure out which of these things seem to be most prominent in predicting or correlating with each of these dimensions. And it was interesting to see that different aspects of how we could sort of describe between individuals, the performance of entrainment and of experience related to these different aspects of metrical behavior in tapping. So, for example, the prominence of the beat frequency in the steady state measurements of EEG was a good predictor of the accuracy. So if there's a stronger articulation mm-hmm. at the beat frequency, whether it was endogenous or exogenous, that predicted well whether or not someone was relatively precisely timing their taps to the beat, while precision was really more clearly related to training experience. So people that were more trained in musical performance were more reliable in the precise timing of taps to a rhythm, which, you know, kind of isn't that surprising. But maybe the most interesting result, at least for me, was that the endogenous beat, so how clearly people added the beat level, that seemed to be the strongest predictor for the temporal prediction. So how well people followed varying tempo. It's a really interesting articulation of how these different pieces of metrical entrainment interact with each other.
What is super important about this is that it combines neural measures and behavioral measures. It's really hard to interpret EEG, neural fMRI, whatever, mm-hmm. without any sort of behavioral task to match it to. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think they do a really good job at packing a lot of stuff into this really cool project and making all these links between behavior and neural entrainment. Just at base, I think this whole concept and evidence that pain emits activity at the frequency of the beat we're listening to, I think that's insane. I think mm-hmm, that's so cool. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And really interesting to look into. What we're doing as a group, and Memorial has done with this replication, is we've extended it to older listeners. Mm. We could say there's two big ideas or big theories with aging. One is that as we age, our cortical encoding of basically everything sort of becomes weaker and more spread out. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, though, is that we also know that older people have much more reliance and much stronger use of crystallized knowledge. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's a question as to whether, you know, would we see stronger encoding in older adults mm-hmm. for that endogenous rhythm, for the syncopated rhythm. And so this was really interesting to look at in older listeners to see, you know, how does the encoding of musical rhythm change? Because in music cognition and aging, there really isn't that much work. And so this is a really cool project to replicate in terms of aging.
Oh, that's another kind of individual participant difference that should be important and informative. Well, then I think we're about ready to go and talk with Sylvie. So that should be great to hear how this project came about and then maybe what her thoughts would be on how this can be extended.
I'd be curious to hear, what she would think would happen to older people.
Yeah. And now joining us on the line is Sylvie Nozradan from the Institute of Neuroscience at UC Louvain in Belgium. Hello, Sylvie.
Hi.
So first, could you tell us a little bit about where this project came from? How did you come to work on this question of metrical qualities from inside the brain and, you know, outside and behavior?
Well, I guess the question came to my mind when I was practicing music myself as a musician. I was studying music at the Conservatoire Supérieur at that time, and I had plenty of questions about how we perceive rhythm, how we are able to synchronize between each other in a group as musicians or, you know, on a dance floor, that kind of things. And so I decided to some scientific studies at the uni to try and understand that, do some research on that. And then I started a PhD on the question, and I'm still working on that question now, actually. This study just was in that stream of research, so trying to understand how the human brain is able to make sense of external rhythms and how we can synchronize to these rhythms.
So a big part of this particular study is comparing syncopated and unsyncopated rhythms. Why did you prioritize that difference in rhythmic qualities?
Syncopation in music is usually refers to the amount of counter evidence on the beat versus positions of the beats. So it means that some rhythms can have a clear beat marked by strong acoustic cues, accentuated sounds, like drum kicks or that kind of things. And more syncopated rhythms have strong acoustic cues at positions that do not correspond to the beat or to the metric structure in general. And these rhythms are, of course, supposed to be more complex to perceive and to synchronize to because of, well, these rhythms do not provide an explicit acoustic cues related to the meter. So we have to endogenously build this meter in our mind, in our brain.
So the first task that you set up was specifically looking at this EEG measurements. That was the construct in recording, and in particular, looking at what you were calling here steady state evoked potentials. It's a way of looking at EEG measurements that I'm not familiar with. So how did you settle on this particular technique of looking at the EEG data?
Yes, so in this study, we use the term steady-state evoked potential to refer to this quite old technique, way of looking at the EEG data. But in fact, we don't use this term steady-state evoked potential anymore to refer to this analysis now or to this way of looking at the EEG data. So instead of looking at the EEG in the time domain, like the time course of the EEG, we look at, let's say, the peaks that we can see at the different frequencies, so peaks of brain activity, let's say, at specific frequencies that we can find in this EEG spectrum.
Obviously, there'd be time domain relevant information in the EEG, but there's a big question as to how the phases would sort of synchronize or come together with respect to the stimulus. Have you considered or have you been tempted to go back and then look at time domain information, maybe, you know, averaging across the examples that you have or doing dynamic time warping to bring together the recordings across the multiple stimuli to see how these might fit together?
Yes. So this is indeed something that we did. So we look in the frequency domain because there are some advantages to use this frequency domain analysis in this specific case in response to complex rhythms. And we also use in other studies some time domain analysis to try to understand what we see in the frequency domain as well. I think one of the main advantages of this frequency domain analysis is that it gives us a fine-grained mapping between the input and the output at specific frequencies. And here we have specific hypotheses about specific frequencies related to the meter, the metric structure that is perceived by the participants. Of course, these frequency components that we see in the EEG spectrum are related to the relative periodicities that are embedded in the EEG signal, the time domain signal. So in fact, in the different analyses that we've done, we've seen different sorts of correlation between the time domain analysis and the frequency domain analysis. So it means that another way to look at the same kind of information, actually.
In listening to the stimuli and, you know, just trying to understand myself what was going on, I found it actually really hard to find the beat, especially at fast tempos. Like the syncopated rhythm at fast tempos took a long time for me to find the beat. And like, same as you guys. I'm a musician. I was really kind of surprised because on paper, it looks really clear.
These rhythms are quite complex indeed. And we've used these rhythms in different studies now. And we have recorded the tapping of the participants when they were asked to tap the beat. And of course, the tapping is quite variable. So even in musicians, some musicians really feel uncomfortable tapping on this rhythm. And while surprisingly, others are super good at tapping directly on this rhythm. So we have quite a large variability in general in this rhythm, which also reflects, I guess, the complexity of the rhythm. With respect to the facts, we chose a 3-beat rhythm. Well, we tried different kind of rhythms in previous experiments, and we had a really good signal to noise ratio in response to these rhythms. And these rhythms were also a good contrast of high-low syncopation. And also, you know, in one rhythm, we have a very prominent meter-related frequencies in the spectrum of the inputs, while in the other rhythm, that's not the case. So the meter-related frequencies are not prominent in the acoustic energy of the rhythm, in the modulation spectrum of the stimulus itself. So this gives us an interesting contrast to use for our question and these experiments.
I don't quite understand that figure for the sound envelope spectrum, because I've tried to do a fast Fourier transform on the stimuli that we have, and there's one single peak. 2.5 or 1.25.
If you take this the acoustic signal of the rhythm, the sequence, and you extract the envelope of this rhythm, there are different ways to do that. Either using a Hilbert transform, as we did in this study, or using something more similar to a cochlear model, what the cochlear model would do. Then if you you compute the Fourier transform to get the frequency representation of the rhythm, then you will get these peaks at these different frequencies. And as we try to explain in this in the paper, the first peak that we see in the spectrum for all these different rhythms actually correspond to the period of the entire rhythm, repetition of the rhythm within the sequence, because the rhythm is looped continuously within the sequence. And in our case, the last peak that we considered as relevant for our question was corresponding to the periods of the individual sounds or silent intervals in these rhythms, so at a different tempi.
So different harmonics, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
It felt like in this paper, there was just a focus on the beat frequency alone, right? And not much looking into the different levels of harmonics. Because I know Ben and I are looking into the harmonics a lot right now. And are trying to, you know, figure out how to interpret all this.
Yes, so that's, of course, a very good point. So we see a lot of harmonics in the spectra, both in the spectrum of the stimulus and the EEG. And in fact, across the different studies we have done with this approach, we've moved from using only the beat frequency, which is maybe an intuitive way, but not a very comprehensive way to look at what's happening, to measuring what we call the meter-related frequencies, so a subset of frequencies which correspond to the different metric levels that one can perceive when we perceive a meter from these rhythms. So it means different harmonics of that beat frequency, basically.
Right.
And interestingly, when we looked at these same data from this paper and tried the correlation between behavior and the EEG when taking not only the beat frequency as we did in the paper, but these meter-related frequencies, we have an even stronger correlation between behavior and EEG.
Okay.
Which indicates that these meter-related frequencies really make sense. And in fact, that's probably a better way to assess what's happening if we take this meter-related frequencies all together. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because we're also sort of discussing how many harmonics are relevant, right? How far do we want to go?
Yeah, as I said, here in this study and in most of our studies, actually, we had a theoretical assumption about the frequency range that was relevant. So here we started from the frequency which corresponds to the period of the entire rhythm to the frequency which corresponds to the individual notes in the pattern.
So you presented these rhythms at different tempi, but it looks like it might be that people's experience of them changes at different tempo values. So what was guiding your decision to use these different tempo values, and what are the relationship between tempo and maybe perception that seems to be coming through the EEG data?
Yeah, that's of course a very key question for meter perception in general. So meter perception is usually considered to happen within a particular frequency range that has been determined based on behavioral studies, tapping studies, that kind of things. So here we wanted to see how this correlation between EEG and behavior holds across different MP. And so we took like the extremes. The first tempo that we use, the slowest one, is quite slow. And the fastest one is really quite fast and quite challenging for some people, in particular non-musician. Also, a result that we found in this study, we didn't put that into the paper because it was not the main aim of the study to look at it, but we compared musician and non-musicians data, EEG data, and we found a difference related to the tempo. So musicians seem to have a higher relative enhancement of the neural activity at the beat frequency at a higher tempo compared to non-musicians. Mm-hmm. Which is quite interesting.
Okay, great. And they're similar for slower tempi?
And no, so we can't see the difference between musician and non-musician at the slower tempi, but only at fast tempi.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
I see in your description of the tasks, you always presented the stimuli in the same order. Was that with the expectation that people's perception of these rhythms at sort of one speed would then inform and enhance their perception at a higher speed?
Yes. Well, that's what I think. The perception of the meter at one tempo in one rhythm will probably project to the perception of the meter when presented to the faster tempo in the block just after or things like that. And also from unsyncopated to syncopated rhythm, there may be some carryover effects. So because they have perceived the 3-beat meter very maybe easily in the unsyncopated rhythm, this may help them perceive this meter in the syncopated rhythm. So here in this study, the aim was not to have like a pure measure of meter perception without any, that kind of bias. Of course, there is that kind of bias. And here the idea of keeping the blocks in the same order was try to have something really comparable across all participants to make the correlation with the behavior afterwards. But that was also the reason why we decided not to report this result I just told you about, comparing musician and non-musicians across tempi, because of course there is an order effect, so we never know what was the role of this order effect in that case.
You're using bias to your advantage because you're more interested in capturing the perception, and if it's helped by, you know, things around it, that's okay as long as they have a stronger perception of the meter. A point against randomization. All right, I'll take
it. Yeah, I guess that's not usually the way you go, but cool. I would wonder, Sylvie, what kind of predictions you would make for older listeners, because I guess you know that we're replicating this in older people.
Well, I guess the correlation between EEG and movement has to be studied. We can't assume that because we found that in young adults, we'll find the same in older listeners, for instance. That's one question. The link between perception and behavior may not be the same. And then maybe the processing of faster tempi would be different in older adults.
Oh, yeah.
Some studies have shown a global slowdown of the processing. So maybe this could affect the way the faster tempi are processed in these people.
That's an interesting factor.
Yeah. Older adults use more crystallized knowledge. So we wondered if that would have an effect on endogenous, right, versus exogenous. So the syncopated versus unsyncopated.
Yes, that's a really good question as well. Yeah, I have no idea about that. Also depends, Derek, the experience as a musician, I guess. So maybe we could find even stronger difference between musicians and non-musicians in these in older populations. That could be a hypothesis to test.
Yeah. Well, we're still looking through the data, so I can't tell you anything right now.
I'm curious.
Yeah.
I'm curious for both of you, with the replication study and the original study, did you have any way of checking the clarity of syncopated, I guess, perception in these participants? There are people out there that find syncopation very, very difficult to deal with in general. And so is that something that you're able to kind of filter out from these studies?
Well, tapping may give us some clues about how one individual was able to cope with the syncopation in the syncopated rhythm compared to another individual, for instance. In some individual, we had lots of variability in the tapping, while others were very consistent in their tapping on this syncopated rhythm. So that's a way to assess that, I guess.
From what I've heard from the replication was that particularly for syncopated at the faster speeds, the tapping data is really messy. Like people have struggled a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. Yeah. So interestingly, the mean intertap interval is generally corresponding to the 3-bit frequency. But mm-hmm. yeah, as you say, it's really very messy across participants, musicians, non-musicians. So the frequency is consistent usually, but the phase is not so consistent depending right. uh-huh. on the studies. Yeah.
I saw that you're analyzing using circular statistics, and I can imagine that gets really messy mm-hmm. with the tempo.
Yes.
And then, yeah, high tempos, the circular statistics might can go a little wonky.
yeah. This question of, you know, the variability in the phase of perceived beats with these rhythms is also one of the interests of using the frequency domain approach that we've been using. So that way mm-hmm. we are looking at periodicities, frequencies, but we don't make any assumption about the phase. So one participant can perceive the beat at one particular phase, while another may have another phase for the same frequency mm-hmm. of beats. We don't make any assumption about that in our measurements. Just look at the periodicities.
So let's maybe look at task two a little bit more. So you were using precision. So that was how close on average they were to the beat itself, and accuracy, which was how they tended to lead or follow the beat.
Yes.
I see there the sort of the mean asynchrony varied hugely, which you were kind of suggesting. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be a really strong difference in individual participants.
Yes.
Would you expect that to be the same for simpler rhythms? Or do you think that's really an expression of how difficult this maybe was for some people to get a beat sensation from?
From what we discussed with the tapping data on this, in this study, this is probably the reflect of the difficulty in tapping for these participants. Mm-hmm. Well, the advantage of having a complex rhythm to tap on and having lots of variability across participants was to try to make the correlation easier. So if we have a very small variability across participants, it's really hard to make a correlation. While here, the variability was very high, and that was the purpose of the study, of course, to have variable abilities across participants in tapping skills. And then it was easier to try to correlate that with the EEG. Do you see what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also a different way of approaching, right? We don't usually aim for that. Most studies try to,
to
get
exactly.
a really unified response.
Yes.
I guess we mentioned that in the beginning as well. That's the big difference. There's two sort of schools, right? How does everyone do this and how do people differ?
Yes.
All right, let's talk a little bit about task three, because this is the one for which I don't know what the actual stimuli sound like, because it was from a different paper. Yeah, so could you explain a bit more about what people were tapping to?
So because the tempo changes in this sequence for task three is sinusoidal, means it's highly predictable in a way. Of course, the tempo is changing, so it increases the variability in the tapping, so people may not track or anticipate the beats for the tapping so well. But because it is sinusoidal, it is quite predictable because it's repetitive across the cycles of acceleration and deceleration. So it's something like that, 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 et cetera, et cetera. So,
okay, so it was just constantly changing as opposed to a sort of occasional adjustment.
Exactly. Yes, it was a constant change. People try to adjust to this constant change and try to catch.
Or continuous change, not constant change, but yes.
Yes.
Interesting.
So then the question was how well people kind of learned and just kept with it. Mm-hmm. And they were tapping for like 30 seconds at a time at each range?
Yes, I think it was 40 seconds in the
40
in
seconds
for this task three. These sequences have been designed by Peter Keller. So he's the expert with these sequences, and he has used these sequences in lots of his studies, actually, to extract this prediction index, as he calls this measure, how much a participant is able to anticipate the coming sounds instead of tracking, despite these tempo changes.
Mm-hmm. Out of these experiments, you had measurements of prediction, you had precision and accuracy, and then you had the two neural entrainment measurements. Before you actually got to all the analysis, what relationships were you expecting out of these measurements of your individual participants?
Our expectations were a bit like what we described in the hypothesis. We were interested to test the link between these selective entrainment at the beat frequency, as we call that, so this score measure at the beat frequency from the EEG spectrum, and the different behavioral measures. And the other thing was to try to see how these endogenous processes particularly at stake in the syncopated rhythm, this measure to relate to prediction, because the idea was to mm-hmm. see if these endogenous processes help us predict the upcoming beats in a sequence where the beat is not explicitly carried by an acoustic cues like in a syncopated rhythm. Mm-hmm. So that was the idea.
Okay, which is what you found.
Yes.
We thought it was the strongest relationship.
That's always nice.
So one of the challenges with this data set is that you only had a small number of participants that actually
yes.
performed and succeeded in all of the different task components, because there's a lot mm-hmm. of pieces to the study. So yes. you were working off only, 15 or 16 participant values to look at these relationships yes. and individual participants. You know, there's a lot of limits on what you could actually get out of a multiple regression analysis. In each case, there was one component that really came through as being a strong predictor, and it was hard to see how the others might relate. I would suppose that would be because of a lot of collinearity, but is that the case? Was there a lot of sort of shared strong correlation values between all of these factors?
In fact, no. So we checked for collinearity, and there were mm-hmm. no collinear effect across the predictors in this
really
narrow regressions.
So you found that like the degree to which people showed, let's say, the endogenous amplitude quality, that mm-hmm. was not strongly correlated with their overall amplitude at their frequency beat
no.
for this
no.
steady state.
We could have doubts. Yes. That was interesting to observe, but there was no correlation. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Huh. That's very surprising.
and also no correlation with musical training.
Really?
Again, here in this study, we only took into account the beat frequency, which may be too restrictive. So
okay.
we found a correlation with behavior, but as uh-huh. I told you, this correlation was even stronger when taking into account the meter relative frequencies, mm. so a larger subset of harmonic frequencies of the beats. And perhaps if we use these measures, we could find some collinearities
okay.
between the predictors in that case. That's a really good point. But here again, the idea was to see if we could find a link between the brain measures and the movement measures. So, of course, collinearities may be an issue with that kind of linear regression. But at least these regressions would tell us that there is a link between the brain and mm-hmm. and the behavior. That was the main point, of course.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I mean, That the resulted analysis focused basically on one component at a time meant that collinearity wasn't really, affecting the model, obviously,
yeah.
in this case.
Mm-hmm.
But that's so surprising that you didn't have strong correlations between all these other components.
Yes.
Intuitively, as a musician, I would just think all of this stuff goes together, obviously. But
yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But as I said, maybe we would find this correlation when taking into account a larger subset of harmonics.
Yeah.
Yeah,
interesting.
But in their application, we did actually do task three.
Okay.
And it's sort of a slightly varied, so they mostly listen and tap a little bit. So we focused a lot mostly on task one. And we're not even sure if we're going to look at the tapping data or not, but I'm really curious
nice.
Now. It's reassuring to hear that yours was also messy and that something can still come out of it, right? We looked at it and we're like, oh, this is such a mess that probably nothing interesting will be there,
yeah.
but maybe there is.
Yes. In one study I did recently, we tested HMAT controlled and patients with focal stroke lesions, brain areas such as the cerebellum, the basal ganglia. And the HMAT controls were older than the usual average age mm-hmm. our participants have so far. And we found that the tapping was even messier in this population. So even if they were not patient, they didn't have any stroke or anything else. So it could be, I don't know, it's an open question. So it could be that maybe older people have like messier tapping or more variable tapping in general compared to younger adults, I have no idea.
But I feel like at this point it's worth, I feel like this motivates me to actually look into it, even though it's going to be tricky. It's going to be fun.
Well, this reminds me of another question that I have is the role of musical training and the breadth of musical training
mm-hmm.
when doing this kind of inter-participant study. What kind of musicians are you looking at? And then what kind of breadth can you ensure that you have when trying to do this sort of correlation? So, for example, Sylvie, in your study, you were looking at individual differences. How did you ensure that you had a breadth of at least like, you know, musical backgrounds in your participants? Was that in how you collected participants?
So the lab where we run the experiments, the recruitment was done in a way specifically we were aiming for a large variability in the musical mm-hmm. training. So it means that the lab had like a list of musicians, non-musicians, and both were contacted to mm-hmm. try to have the largest sample.
So you at least drew from two different pools of participants.
Yes.
And then assumed mm-hmm. that within each you'd have enough of a spread that you would get not necessarily yes. a linear distribution, but, you know, maybe something more interesting than just modal in
yes.
terms of years of training.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And interestingly, here, if we just correlate, let's say, the number of years of musical training with the brain data, there is no mm-hmm. clear relationship, no correlation. So, but as I said, there may be some effect of musicianship, mm-hmm. like the processing of the tempo, fast tempo versus slow tempo, that kind mm-hmm. of things. Mm-hmm. Of course, it would be super interesting to look at the more subtle differences in the musical training. Let's say different kind of musical genres, like jazz versus mm-hmm. classic training, or mm-hmm. different kinds of like drummers versus violinists, that kind of things. I think yeah. other labs have already looked at it, like Peter Wüst's lab,
yeah.
tried and shown very nice evidence of these differences depending on the kind of musical training one can have.
So do you think that those would then adjust or have implications for these specific different components of metrical experiences and behaviors?
Well, what I would expect, for instance, something that would be fun to test is, let's say we test a drummer, like an expert in metal music, which is a kind of a genre of music mm-hmm. with a very, very fast tempo, mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. probably mm-hmm. one of the fastest tempo we can find in music, and look at the effect of tempo between this group, metal drummer, and other types of musicians. That would be very fun.
Yeah.
And my guess would yeah. be that because they are practicing movements at very fast tempo, and of course processing mm-hmm. sounds at very fast tempo in their music, they would mm-hmm. Have much more ability than other kind of musicians to process these fast tempo rhythms, mm. even single
yeah.
rhythms
yeah, yeah.
or complex rhythms.
Mm. Sarah, have you got musicianship experience sort of in more detail on the population that you've been looking at?
I don't think so. I haven't seen any musicianship data or information at all on it. I just have young people and older people.
But okay. And they're from
They're
from Newfoundland.
Cornerbrook, yes. Yeah. This was all done
okay.
in Cornerbrook, which is on the west coast of Newfoundland. Very isolated community. Mm-hmm. But Newfoundland is very musical. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible place to study music science,
yeah.
actually. It you know, the amount of mm-hmm. people who play music of any kind, whether it be folk music or you know, just play in a cover band or sing in choirs. There's mm-hmm. an incredible amount of choirs over there. Or play classical music.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very, very common.
Yeah. And so, I mean, thinking about the folk music of Newfoundland, there's a lot of like swung rhythms and stuff like that, or what we could describe as swung rhythms with sort of like loping patterns and stuff, mm-hmm. Which would suggest to have a pretty refined sense of metrical hierarchy in order to support those kinds of behaviors. So
yeah,
now I'm wondering about how well your results would then compare to what we might measure in, you know, in older populations and in other places, just because of potentially a distinct musical advantage from this from mm-hmm. this community.
Yeah. For future studies, I always like to take care of, you know, to take into account musical background and
yeah.
I use the Gold MSI. I went to Goldsmiths, so yeah. So then that tells you not only how much experience they have in terms of like theory and lessons, but it tells you what instrument they play. And so we're able to then even look mm-hmm. in more detail and say like, okay, string players, brass players, percussionists, singers, etc. And we can start to look into those comparisons because yeah. I think it's so, so relevant and so interesting. And Newfoundland is, a really, really interesting place to study this.
Well, the rhythmic sensitivity of a fiddle player shouldn't be the same, I would guess, as a violinist. So mm-hmm. there's lots of questions there.
So many people do both.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. So a question I'm always left with when talking about music science is how do these experiments relate to then our kind of everyday musical activities? Mm. What does this suggest about the way in which we, you know, mm-hmm. either make music or listen to music? How does this relate to what's going on in our heads or coming out of our bodies? That doesn't sound right, but you know what I mean.
Well, to me, this question opens to very important, interesting question for our research relative to the use of more naturalistic stimuli. So here we used a very, well, those rhythms are very complex, as can be seen from the tapping behavior on these rhythms. But the sounds themselves, they are very simplified, of course. And these were really repeated patterns, that kind of things. So naturalistic music would be an interesting step forward to try to make this link between everyday life, music perception, and what we understand is happening in the brain when we listen to music.
Well, one of the questions that comes to mind in thinking about using more typical music examples than just like artificial rhythm reductions is the question of cognitive load. In that, you know, if someone, for example, is listening to something with a lot of different instruments playing and that has an interesting melody and there's all this other stuff to pay attention to, I mean, at least on the musician side, the more stuff that's going on, the harder it is to concentrate. And so that can actually have quite a negative effect on someone's accuracy.
On the other hand, in our everyday life, we always have this experience, I guess, at least musicians, that even if the music is very complex and variable in terms of instruments and all kind of things, we can keep the beat quite easily in different sorts of music. So that's the point, I guess. So despite this high variability and this potential mental load due to the complexity of the stimulus itself, it's striking how easily we can keep the beat when listening to, I don't know, a techno music or something like that, for instance.
I wondered if this would also apply to, you know, listening to a piece of music, because this is very simplified stimuli. You know, can you see such a clear peak and, you know, you're listening to whatever's on the radio? Is that what your brain's doing? Like, well, that would be super cool.
As a matter of fact, we are currently doing an experiment. Well, we are finishing an experiment where we tried to use the same approach. So looking at these frequency, these meter related frequencies in the EEG spectrum in response to naturalistic music, as we call that. So music that have not been composed or designed for an experimental purposes, like in the lab, but for dance or entertainment or whatever. So we took a different techno tracks, and we could observe these quite significant signal-to-noise ratio, these meter-related frequencies emerging in the EEG spectrum. So that's a work in progress, but it's quite it's quite interesting to see that. And I think that's, as I was saying, that's a very important step to try to generalize these results to more naturalistic stimuli.
So, you know, people often ask me what I do, and I'll talk about these things. They'll be like, oh, did you know that when you listen to music, the rhythm is like encoded in your brain? And they're like, oh, really? I'm like, yeah, it's super cool. But actually, this, like, the evidence so far is only on these dry rhythms.
It's really hard to show that.
Well, actually, how far can I claim this?
But to me, finding a clear brain activity, a strong brain activity at the beat frequency in a naturalistic music, let's say, with a very salient, very prominent beat in the stimulus itself, it's quite trivial in a way, because we would expect that from a very basic auditory system, of course. But more interesting are these natural, these naturalistic music tracks where the metric structure is not explicit in the music. So where there is no prominent acoustic energy at the meter frequencies. And so I'm mostly interested in these tracks because this is an excellent way to try to observe these endogenous processes. So not only stimulus-driven responses, but these endogenous processes are related to meter perception, actually. So we are trying to go into that direction now.
I wonder what something that is sort of arrhythmic would sound like, something like, you know, atmospheres or a lot of Ligeti's work, where there's no beat, right? You can't tap your foot to it. You know, how are we structuring that and how are we making sense of it?
One potential idea there is that, like we sometimes do with atonal works, we kind of briefly try to interpret things in relationship to maybe tonal frameworks that make sense to us. Similarly, we maybe are doing the same thing metrically, where we kind of think, oh, maybe this is a little bit like something. And so we'll have an expectation that could be articulated through these...
Like an implicit meter reception arising.
Yeah, and then have it constantly be violated until maybe we just give up. I don't know. But I mean, I wonder how much we can help ourselves. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is a way of peeking into that process of how listeners may be trying to fit and then make sense of these processes that may not have the rewards in them to kind of confirm and sustain some kind of metrical framework.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It would be fun to see that kind of constant construction and failing. I don't think we have the technology or the processing yet to pick up on that directly, but it suggests that it could be there underneath if we ever get the right kind of experiment in place to measure. Lots of pieces of this. Mm-hmm. Well, as we come to understand more about what's going on here, maybe we'll actually get a chance to answer some of these questions.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Sylvie, for coming on and sharing all of this insight into your study.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was really interesting. Sylvie had a lot of cool stuff to say. How did you find it, Sarah?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was really great to hear from her as you know, I've been working on the replication of this paper. So it was really cool to hear more about the original from the author herself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got some questions answered.
Yeah. I can imagine you've got a lot more, too, out of this.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. But those will be for a later day.
Yeah. Are you ready to give us a summary of what the paper is about now that we've got, like, the insider view as well as the paper itself?
Yeah, I'll give it a go. So I would describe it as a combination of three tasks that encompass the cortical aspect of meter entrainment and physical production of meter, as well as prediction. We've got these three aspects across these three tasks. So the first task was listening to two different rhythms. One of them was not syncopated and one of them was syncopated. So that was the big difference between the two. Finding that cortical activity is stronger for non-syncopated rhythms than it is for syncopated rhythms at that beat frequency.
Mm-hmm.
The second task was a tapping task. People found it a lot easier in general, I think, to tap to the unsyncopated rhythms and the slower rhythms particularly. So there was a lot of difficulty with the faster rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
What was really cool is that we found out that there was a difference in musicians and non-musicians as well, with musicians being, I guess, more precise in their tapping, particularly at faster rhythms, but were equal to non-musicians at slow rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this information on cortical entrainment, we've got this information on tapping, and then the third task had to do with prediction. So it was really actually great to hear what the stimuli actually was like, that it was a constant change of tempo, but that was predictable. So it was constantly speeding up or constantly slowing down. So there was like the derivative was straight, if you will.
It was continuous in its change.
Yeah.
Not
exactly
constant in its change. It was sinusoidal in its change.
Continuous in its change. Yeah, so then there was this measure of predictability. We found that people were more predictive than lagging, essentially. And so we have this combination of measures where these cortical measures predict behavior in different ways. The stronger entrainment of neural activity to the beat was related to tapping accuracy. People with more musical training had better precision. And then the individuals who had stronger endogenous encoding were better at prediction in the third task.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so those are the three relationships, yeah?
Yeah. To show a strong articulation at beat frequency to the syncopated rhythm, that correlated well with capacity to predict clearly in the tempo variable task.
Yeah. So it was really nice to hear that there was also consideration of different harmonics, because that's what we've been concentrating a lot in our analysis of our application. And in going back to the paper, I sort of realized, oh, actually, they only focus on the beat frequency. But in talking with Sylvie about, you know, the meter level and then the little note levels and how, yeah, this is all interesting and we should all look at it, is reassuring. And it's also, it was cool to hear that so the whole rhythm as one cycle had actually stronger correlations to the behavioral tasks than the beat frequency itself. So that's something that I'm definitely curious to go into our data to see if that's the case as well. Because though we do have it, we don't explicitly look at that lower harmonic yet. We were focusing on beat frequency and higher harmonics and not really the lower ones. So really good to know.
Because there's this question of harmonics and sort of beat, you know, whether there is an expression of high amplitude in this frequency analysis of EEG that looking at the amplitudes, not only at the meter level and then also the beat level and other subdivisions, all of those harmonics are important. But by using a sort of three beat cycle, you're breaking the simple octave problem that comes up in a lot of meter research,
right?
At least when we're looking at, you know, the EEG data, makes those a little bit easier to disentangle. So I like that. I mean, at the same time, 3-4 is a little bit less familiar to people depending on their musical background, but it's convenient in this case, just from like a numerical structure.
I think it's also difficult because that first unsyncopated rhythm has a beat and then silence immediately. So it's really hard when you're listening to it very fast to really establish that as a downbeat because there's that silence right after.
Well, something we didn't talk about in our conversation with Sylvie was how much time you kind of wait for people to actually get oriented to a clear sense of the meter, because you kind of want to focus on the EEG recordings over the period where people have a clear metrical hierarchy in mind. And sometimes that can take a little bit of time. And I know that from their description of the analysis, they dropped the first second and the last second of the stimulus exposure time. But I'm wondering, based off of your description of your experience with these stimuli when they're played really fast or really slow, if maybe the picture would be a bit clearer if you waited, you know, maybe 10 seconds or something before you recorded, so that you could focus in on those intervals where there should be a really clear expression of some kind of metrical perception, whether it's what you want or not from as an experimenter, you know, at least people will have made some kind of sense out of it.
Yeah, I think we have about 40 seconds in our data. So it'd be interesting to see if, you know, from second 10 onwards has different. I don't know if it'd be, you know, maybe stronger peaks, right? We're looking at strength of peaks. That's really what we're after, right? Is to get really clear beat frequency peaks and their harmonics and seeing what comes out of it.
I have a vague memory of someone who was looking at, it must have been EEG recordings, in presenting ambiguous rhythms that could be heard either in, it was probably some kind of six beat cycle that could be heard as two chunks of three or three chunks of two, and using maybe EEG to sort out where the prominence was. If that study hasn't been done, it really should be. I think I've heard something about it before.
Inducing a meter perception?
Yeah, inducing meter perception and then being able to sort out maybe the... Yeah. It would give you another contrast condition, right? So as opposed to syncopation versus unsyncopation, you could see whether there's a boost that's associated with that kind of pulse level.
No, I was going to mention that. I think there's a study with SSEPs where in a binary rhythm, there is, you know, frequency brain activity at a binary level, whereas if it is a triple meter, same rhythm, but induced in triple, then the encoding in the brain changes. So we might be thinking the same paper.
We might be. Okay. All right. Well, hopefully someone knows what paper we're talking about and can let me know. And I will tweet it out once I have a clue as to whose work I'm talking about. And I'm sorry to the person whose work I've forgotten, because it sounds like it's a really important result to keep in mind when talking about these things. Were there any other surprises for you when we got a chance to talk to Sylvie about the details?
Not really surprises. It was just nice to get the confirmation of a couple of things, right? Nice to know that, yes, musical training was looked at. Nice to know that different harmonics were looked at. Those relationships really were considered. And everything really made sense, right? Like, so why choose a triple meter? That makes sense now. And like, you know, it just sort of clarifies a lot of things as to how to look at this replication, this new data. Like I mentioned, it's a sort of replication. It took me a while at the beginning to sort of sort out what exactly had gone on, because I didn't collect the data, because I didn't do the study.
Yeah.
I'm just coming in with, here's the data, a little bit of background.
Yeah.
Which is cool, you know, I had to start somewhere, so it's great fun to get started with something right away. I think this is a really interesting project. But so there are only two tempos, and the listening phase is simply click tracks. So there was another control done where participants listened to just click tracks.
So you've got isochronous at the different tempos as well as the rhythms.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly. And they just listened. And that was to demonstrate aging effects, right? Because we are primarily an aging lab. Is there a difference between older and younger people if there's just a click track? And the general effect is that the encoding is weaker in older adults.
Okay.
So like, okay, cool. There's an effect there. Mm-hmm. Can we do it with syncopated, non-syncopated, different tempos?
Yeah.
And this kind of stuff. And so far, it's a little bit fuzzier. Still looking into it.
One thing that surprised me in the discussion that I learned as you two talked to each other about the kind of the difficulty of people perceiving meter in these rhythms was that by design, some of the inter-individual variability is, you know, a failure to entrain clearly, which at least at the tapping performance level. And that leaves me with a lot of questions about whether that's even fair to compare, because it seems like a different state. But I mean, it makes sense that that would relate to experience and maybe capacity according to all these different metrics. But I wonder what's actually then being reported. Doing a linear regression when you're including two different types of experiences, I wonder what it is that we're really looking at there, or what should be read into those numbers when there is that difference. Now, granted, a lot of their numbers come from bringing information together across all the different conditions. So it could be that those instances of, like, you know, failure to entrain well, some of it was tossed out because of the sorting out of how many people were participating. And, you know, but some of it is also affecting the numbers and the statistics involved. So
it's always tricky here. I'm always really cautious of overinterpretation. It's really easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
We've had this discussion a couple of times about replication in my lab at Queen Mary, and you know how we keep talking about how it's great science and it's good practice and everyone should do more replications, but it's really hard.
But
the great advantage now of being in this lab is that I get to take a whole bunch of studies that have been done already in young adults and replicate them for older adults. I have this really great excuse to just carry out a whole bunch of replications for the next couple of years, and this is, you know, just a start. So I'm really happy with that sort of opportunity and what we can do with it.
Yeah. There's a lot to be done, not just repeating, but extending results to see how these values change if they really work out when we're including other variables.
Yeah. And in almost all cases, it'll be like a comparison. I'll still have young people and we're going to compare so that there's some sort of ground, right? You know, you do replication with only older adults and you don't have any young to compare to. You don't know, like, you don't have your control or your ground.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make any meaningful comparisons to existing research.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to see what kinds of things come out of your study as well, given now what I've learned about Sylvie's original take.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully we'll be able to sort it out in the new year and the next couple of months have something submitted.
Yes. Every time I work on other people's data, I think, oh, this is actually so much more difficult than I thought it would be. But anyway, I hope your experience is more is a little bit more efficient than mine.
For me, I think the biggest challenge is interpretation, because I'm not familiar with the EEG work at all. It's the first time I do any EEG project and a long time since I've done anything rhythmically related. The challenge is mostly about, you know, picking out what's relevant, what's the best analysis to do, and what's the best way of explaining this data.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a really important paper in connecting so many different ideas. You know, in the discussion, they talk about four or five different things that this relates to, right? They, of course, bring in predictive coding, as is becoming very popular. And we're talking about synchronization. They talk about different animals as well, different species. And so that's a whole other aspect that this relates to. And, like, this gives so much to literature in a little compact paper. I love it.
All right. Well, that is it for our discussion of individual differences in rhythmic cortical entrainment correlate with predictive behavior in sensory motor synchronization. Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you.
If you like what you heard and you want to support this podcast, consider reviewing it on iTunes or wherever you listen and share your favorite episode on social media. And if you want to get in touch, you can follow the podcast on Twitter, So Strangely Pod. You can find us on Facebook at the So Strangely Podcast, or check out the website and blog, sostrangely.com. And if you're a music science researcher with your hands on a new publication that you think people should hear about, get in touch so we can help you make that happen, just like Sarah did.
Yay.
Drop us a line through the contact form at sostrangely.com or email me directly at finn@sostrangely.com. Thank you for listening. And until next time, keep digging into how and why music sometimes behaves so strangely.
Sometimes behaves so strangely. Sometimes behaves so strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely.